Thank you very much for making the effort to come out on the first one. You can see, as a good Brit, I have my two drinks at all times, you know. But this morning, it's coffee versus anything else, I promise. I hope you're all having a fantastic Ignite. I feel like a presidential candidate or something. It feels like there's a bit of a barrier here. My name is Alex Bradley. I work for a lady called Julia White, who, if you've been to the Ignite in Chicago or Microsoft conferences, might recognize Julia. She and our organization are responsible for what we call technical product management of Office 365. And so we take care of working with the engineers to figure out what we need to be building and then how we present that out to the marketplace. And that's a lot about the next sort of 18 months to 2 to 3 years in the service. And then once things are delivered, actually translating what the engineers actually end up building from what we intended, and then trying to translate that out to the real world, and vice versa, taking feedback from you guys and presenting it back to our engineering folks so that they can think about how they want to evolve the Office 365 service. We've had some interesting developments over the last 6 months. We've taken the consumer OneDrive and consumer Skype teams and brought those together with the commercial OneDrive and Skype for Business teams. So it's a really interesting time. You know, we've got even more engineering resource, and we're focused on continuing with rapid iteration with Office 365. So I work for Julia, and I'm responsible for what we call commercial narrative. So what I've got here is a presentation that talks about how we see the world of work changing, and as a result, how and where we're making investments in the Office 365 service, and beyond, actually, to be fair. You know, it's very much as I think about the cloud services at Microsoft, it's most customers that I talk to, and I talk to customers in our executive briefing center once or twice a week, are choosing a cloud platform. They're not just saying, hey, I'm going to pick Exchange Online, or I'm going to pick, OneDrive for storage. They're actually taking a sort of a slightly more holistic view, because, as part of it, there's device management. As part of it, there might be the CRM aspect. As part of it, there might be the, the cloud OS sort of platform. So they're sort of picking that platform. So having that breadth of engineering resources is fantastic. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how things are evolving, where we're making investments. I have some of the new Office 2016 client apps and some of the new service experience that I can show you. I'll try and get through things in about 45 minutes or so, 45, 50 minutes, and leave at least 10 minutes at the end for questions. You can always follow me on Twitter as well, which is AMCGB. So we start off by talking, exactly the presentation that I use with, customers in that executive briefing center, and all this week with, customers up in Wellington and, down here, talking about this shift. And this shift is, how have things changed? We used to have a slide where we talked about the world has changed. And that's a slightly obvious statement, I think. The fact that the world has changed is no different, or is no more true today than it was 10 years ago, 100 years ago. What I think is different is the pace of change. If you think of, the fact that 15, 20, 10, 15 years ago, we had, faxes, emails, phone calls, and that was pretty much about it. Whereas now you think about the plethora of different sort of messaging applications, communications modalities, it's pretty staggering. There's a scary statistic of how many of the Fortune 500 companies that were listed in 1955 are still in existence. And sadly, only 11% are still in existence. So in the course of 50 years, 90% of companies have, gone out of business. What's even more interesting is that in that 1955, the average time that a company, once it made it onto the Fortune 500, the average time that it stayed on the Fortune 500 was 35 years. Now, today, the average time that a company, once it makes it on, stays on, is about 14 years. And that time is continuing to go down. So what has changed is the pace of change, the cacophony of sort of apps and data and things, along with some of the changes in terms of how people consume things. So the first one, customers versus brand ambassadors. Customers are no longer this sort of passive, group of people. They are going out on social media. They expect to interact with companies on social media. If you're not available and able to see and track sentiment and trend and talk to people where they are or empower people to have an authentic conversation, you're sort of missing out. I read literally just this morning, there's a hotel in Sydney called Hotel 1888. The building was from 1888. And they call themselves the world's first Instagram hotel. And the reason being, if you've got 10,000 Instagram followers, they will give you a free night. And every single month, the post of someone who tags the hotel that gets the most number of likes, that person gets a free night. You know, so we live in this world where they're not paying for PR, they're paying for people to do that for them on Instagram. So that's a sort of big shift. And, you know, in order to take advantage of that as organizations, you have to be thinking about things like social listening. You have to empower people to get out there on those social networks. You know, when I started at Microsoft 10 years ago back in the UK, I remember I was talking to one of the major broadcasters. It wasn't the public one, so that kind of narrows it down. I was talking to one of the major broadcasters, and they had their call center up in Scotland. And we were talking about instant messaging. This was just when Live Communication Server was coming out, which became Office Communication Server, which became Link, which became Skype for Business. We do like changing the name of things. And they just didn't get, like, why would I want my call center people to have instant messaging? They're just going to mess around on it. You know, it's not, you know, they're going to use it for fun. And I couldn't sort of get them over this barrier. What was hilarious about that was two things. One, now that seems quaint and sort of antiquated. You know, the idea of people in a contact center being able to rapidly get answers to questions whilst they're on a phone call seems to make perfect sense. The other thing that was hilarious was I found out that these non-technical workers up in Livingston in Scotland were using the DOS command prompt and had hacked a way of doing instant messages on the terminals between each other anyway. So, you know, you're not going to prevent this. And actually, that ties, that sort of almost makes you think of the last one on this, security in the server room versus security in the boardroom. You know, so I started in the UK, did 3 years as a working with on-premises productivity solutions, and then I moved across to work on the predecessor to Office 365. I joined when we had no service in no countries with no users. That was a fun experience, launching it and, you know, now growing to, you know, over millions and millions and millions of users. But when I started, like 2008, 2009, you'd be having these conversations with customers, and they instinctively thought that a server that was in their data center, or more often than not, under someone's desk, was somehow inherently more secure. And I think over the last couple of years, whether it's with, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, Target, Sony Pictures, you know, companies that are able to spend almost, you know, seemingly unlimited sums on their security, that's just not true. So, you know, people will find a way around things, and security has never been more important. So having the ability to secure things, you know, in a massive way is very important. Some of the bits in the middle I think are interesting, you know, and I'll talk a little bit more about the networks, insights, creative value creation. Transactional systems of intelligence, this is very much around the relating to the trend. So we've talked a lot about our mission is to empower every person and organization on the planet to achieve more. And what we're talking about today is this reinventing productivity and business process. I focus on the productivity piece, but the business process is around how do you have business processes that help enhance productivity versus hinder productivity. You know, I know that when I get back from this trip, I'm going to have a couple of hours worth of pain when I do my expenses. You know, that is not a good use of my time, and it's not a good business process. So this shift from now, how many people have seen the Office Lens app? Anyone? Okay, you know, a few people. Check out the Office Lens. It's in the App Store, it's in Google Play, it's in the Windows Store. It's a fantastic app. So anyone who's a OneNote power user, you want Office Lens in your life. What it can do is it takes pictures of, you know, whiteboards or receipts and things like that, de-skews it using technology from MSR. So if you take like a whiteboard like half on, it actually sort of brings it, bumps up the color, and you can save it direct to OneNote. I now use that for my expenses. Take a snap of the receipt, goes into OneNote. You know, that's made my life easier. Now, if MSIT could just, you know, get their head around, you know, pulling that out of my OneNote, then everybody would be happy. One of the biggest shifts, and we, you know, various speakers at the conference has talked about this, the shift towards millennials. And oftentimes, when speakers of an older generation speak about millennials, it's in the tone of, oh, we've got this narcissistic selfie generation. I've got to hire them, but I hate them. Is pretty much what I sometimes get. What's interesting, I think, about the millennial hire is, first of all, they're not going anywhere. You know, they're only increasing. Over 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every single day in the United States. And they're not being replaced by, Gen X, Gen Y. They're being replaced by millennials. By most accounts, they're already the largest generation in the workforce. So they do think differently. They do are motivated differently. They want to feel empowered. Imagine going to a school or a college or doing some graduate hiring and then showing them an old XP machine with Office 2003. You know, do you think that that employee is going to be motivated to join your organization? It's not going to happen. So on the one hand, this generation thinks a little bit differently and is and wants to be empowered and have latest technology, and they've grown up, you know, in this world of social networks. I didn't have my first mobile phone until I was, I think I was 17, almost 18. I had a pager before that. That's how ridiculous, you know, can you remember pagers? But this is a generation that's grown up with Facebook, Twitter, you know, and so on. So they communicate very differently. They are also having an impact on how we work and how we interact. You know, I mentioned that idea of customers and brand ambassadors and how we expect to interact with companies on Twitter. You know, I do use Twitter. I do sort of share out articles. I do a monthly webcast where we live tweet during the show and things like that. But you know what? When I started, the whole purpose behind Twitter for me was around getting access to customer service. You know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have dreamed, right? You know, you pick up the phone and speak to Air New Zealand, or in my case, in the United States, Delta. Now, I do everything humanly possible to avoid picking up the phone. I want to use Twitter. So the millennials are not only, you have to think differently about how you attract, retain, and empower them, but then they're, you know, don't, you know, be in any doubt that they're also impacting on how we work. My younger brother, he started at a financial services organization in London about 8-9 years ago. And they had just deployed office communication server for instant messaging and presence. And I asked him, you know, about it. And he was like, yeah, it's great. And I was like, you know, so, you know, what sort of stuff do you do on it? And he was like, well, you know, pretty much everyone under 27 uses it. Whereas now, if you think about that, I think things are a little bit different, you know, whether it's Skype. You know, Skype is a great example. I Skype with everybody from my grandmother to my godson, you know, my three-year-old godson. You know, and it's terrifying that my three-year-old godson can actually use Skype. It's equally terrifying that my grandmother can use Skype. But it is the technology that sort of transcends barriers. And so that rapid adoption of these sort of, you know, technologies in our personal lives hasn't really been mirrored in our professional lives. You know, how many people still, you know, use email as a primary communications form? Like, actually, just out of interest, how many people still have file shares and that's what people use versus cloud storage? File shares? That's quite a lot. How many people, and be honest, send emails around as a way of collaborating? Now, keep your hands up, actually. Keep your hands up. If you send emails around as a way of collaborating, keep your hand up if you think that that is a good way to collaborate. Okay, two people. It's frustrating. It's super frustrating. You know, when I'm, you know, working off of a document that someone has sent me offline, I almost get angry. Anyone who's been to Seattle, people talk about the Seattle freeze. I've lived there for 7.5 years now. It's known for being very passive aggressive. So I channel my inner Seattleite and I get very passive aggressive on email. You know, you could put this on OneDrive. But when I get that attachment, it's frustrating to me for two reasons. One, I know that either I'm wasting my time because I'm working on a document that's already out of date, and therefore, why am I doing this? Or some poor sod is going to have to collate 17 different versions of edited things and collate it into one. And that's a terrible, terrible use of time. My time in the first instance, and the corporation's time in the second instance. And in a world in which that pace of change is just rapidly going up, we can't afford that. So again, the millennials really have shifted things in that regard, both in terms of how we work and expect to work, as well as how we attract and retain them. So I said I'd talk a little bit more about, you know, networks and the sort of the value creation thing. This slide is a sort of a compare and contrast. It's a little bit like that shift side in terms of before and after. On the left-hand side, you know, we have the sort of the old world. Information moves slowly, command and control. On the right-hand side, information travels fast, learn and adapt. Now, what are these things sort of saying? First of all, in a traditional hierarchy, that's what you see on the left. And that's stemming from, or two places, really. I mean, it has its roots back in, you know, how the Roman army organized itself, you know, unsurprisingly. But really, modern organizations grew out of the Industrial Revolution, where prior to the Industrial Revolution, you basically had, you know, the boss and you had the serfs. Whereas with the Industrial Revolution, as companies and organizations, whether it was the East India Trading Company, whether it was Ford, whether it was General Electric, whether it was the railway network in the United States as they, you know, went out west, they had to think about a way of, you know, a span of control and, you know, created these sort of hierarchies that were modeled on traditional organizations. Now, this is great in a world in which you want to focus on control and efficiency. However, in a world in which you actually rapidly want to take advantage of new pieces of information, it's probably not the best way, because for information to make its way up to someone who has the power to make a decision, you've got to go up several little layers of command making, and then it's got to work its way all the way back down. Prior to joining Microsoft, I term it as playing soldiers because I was never in the regular army in the UK. I was in the territorial army. But I think back to that. You know, then if you wanted to make decisions on the battlefield, you had to feed it back up. It went up to RHQ, boom, 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 and then it would come back down again. Now, why do I tell this sort of the military story? It's because on this side, there's a great case study, and it's a great book by a guy called General Stanley McChrystal, who's an American general who was tasked with turning around what was a pretty horrific situation in Iraq 2 to 3 years after the original invasion by America and the Allied forces. He got to Iraq, and he realized that the Allied forces, let's be honest, the Brits and the Americans, were still working like this. You know, very command and control. However, think about the challenge and the enemy that he was facing. He wasn't facing a nation state. He wasn't facing a military. He was facing these diffuse networks of unaligned terrorist groups or jihadi groups who weren't acting like this and who were taking advantage of Twitter, Facebook, to rapidly organize, change plans, iterate. So he realized that in order to fight a network, he had to work like a network. And so he did a few different things. First of all, devolved a lot of power, you know, started empowering people closer to the front line versus that command and control. And that's a scary thing for people in some organizations who've spent, you know, decades focused on efficiency. But efficiency at the price of agility. Now, where that balance shifts between efficiency and agility is going to be different for every single organization. But in the world where we have this pace of change, I think most people understand that, you know, we do have to be more agile, and part of that is empowering people. So he did one thing, devolving power. Then the other thing was communications. He did something unheard of in the military. He brought together everybody for a conference call every single morning, all of the military branches and all of the three-letter acronyms on video conference calls. And the video is really important because by various standards, around two-thirds of communication is nonverbal, which is why I hate, you know, the fact that there's a podium here. So I'd be sort of hiding behind the podium. You can't sort of see things. You know, how people are using their hands, the pitch, the intonation, the facial expressions, incredibly important. And that nuance is very important. How many people either have or know of people who have a little post-it note or a piece of sellotape over the webcam on their laptop? I find that, like, fascinatingly crazy. Like, when was the last time you turned on your webcam on a work conference call, you know, and you were in your bathrobe or something? Like, it's never happened. It's never happened. But anyway, people still do this. They're kind of scared about it. But he forced people to do this. And in doing so, what happened was they had more rapid sharing of information and ultimately were able to sort of go through the deck of cards, capture people, you know, and with the surge, you know, begin to turn things around, at least at that time. So that's interesting in terms of how you sort of balance things between the sort of command and control versus learning and adapting. And the things where I see organizations on this side of the spectrum taking advantage of technologies is, you know, things like, we mentioned already, social listening. There are multiple social listening tools out there. And then empowering people to get out there on social channels. How many people are on the Office 365 technical network on Yammer? Oh, only a couple. All right, so on Yammer, and this is a public group, the technical network, Office 365 technical network, I can find the short link in a second when I'm on the PC. We used to do, well, you've had websites, we've had TechNet, we'd have those sort of things. Our primary way of IT pro readiness for Office 365 now is the Office 365 technical network. It's got over, last time I checked, it was well over 50,000. Like when we did Ignite in Chicago, we were hitting the 50,000 mark. And so, you know, who knows what it is now. But this is where, you know, we share information, and we share it pretty early on. And the engineers have got excited about the Office 365 technical network. Before, I couldn't get an engineer to come and talk to a person, you know, if I, you know, paid them. And believe me, I actually did. But in that briefing center I mentioned back in Redmond, dragging a pure engineer, a coder into that room, they're terrified. You know, they're introverts. They hate talking to people. However, you give them this online social network where they can go and do polls and get real-time feedback. You know what the engineers love? They love data. So the ability to put a poll out, do you like widget A or do you like widget B? You know, and for that to be built into how they now think about how I'm building things, as well as getting out and sharing information about how they've built things and whatnot. That's a marked change in how we as a business are being more agile versus them passing it off to me passing it off to people in the field, you know, blah, 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 blah. So that's a good example of how you know some of the things that you, people think about there. Next piece of the puzzle is around how people are organizing at the moment. You know, on the left-hand side, fixed and siloed teams, and on the right-hand side, this you know this idea of leveraging an on-demand talent pool. This one on the left, the fixed and siloed teams, is interesting. When I started at Microsoft, again, you teams were very much fiefdoms. You know, whether it was your own team at the front line in the UK, or whether it was the Windows, you know, org in Microsoft versus the Office org in Microsoft, you know. And actually, Steve Ballmer, you know, explicitly said, you know, we're basically like a venture capital company, you know, just a really well-funded one. And every single year, you know, Steve and the board would decide, hey, I'm going to give Office this much, you know, Windows this much. And that led to this internecine sort of warfare, you know, where Windows would come up with their own mail client when we have this thing called Outlook, you know, and would lead to weirdness. But that's because of these siloed teams. The fixed teams are also interesting because in a world of this sort of constant change and evolution, you know, the idea of having like a team of six people that stays static throughout a calendar year, again, some disciplines, you know, a finance team, yeah, maybe that makes sense. But when I think about my communications team, the where we are in the year, whether it's Ignite season or whether we're preparing for what we term mid-year review, or whether we're getting ready to launch Office 2016 this month on the September 22nd. So launch mode, review mode, conference mode. They're very different. But the idea that I can have six individuals that you know do nothing but these things and move between these different disciplines, which are very different disciplines, is, in my mind, absurd. So I don't have a team of six. I only have a team of two. But then I tap into you know, vendor resource, or I go to our events team and I pull someone from the events team onto my team for the Ignite conference to, you know, to support me for a fixed period of time. And so that's how, you know, we're sort of beginning to adapt and evolve. And my favorite example here is Zara, the Spanish fashion company. They're in what they term fast fashion. And they rely on sort of being able to recognize trends, see what's selling, manufacture it, and get it into stores, you know, incredibly quickly. Now, what's interesting about that is they have, you know, again, think about this side. This side was about efficiency. This side is about agility. Zara, as a, you know, yes, they're a retail company, but they're also a supply chain company. And anyone who works in a supply chain knows that you want that efficiency. You want to be running that supply chain as efficiently as possible. Zara have explicitly tapped out their manufacturing capacity resources at 80%. They deliberately leave 20% open and, you know, potentially idle. The reason being, they want to have a look at what's selling. You know, oh, that gray pencil skirt is selling like hotcakes in Manila in the Philippines. Well, let's ramp up production. Let's get it in there. Let's do a promo. Let's get some PR. Now, that sounds good and that may, you know, makes sense. But then think about what needs to happen. You know, the individual store managers or the people on the front line in Manila need to be able to report on how sales are going. Then someone needs to be empowered to say, all right, plants in Seville in Spain, we're going to fire up more. How much more? You need to be able to get insight into data. Then you need to think about how you're going to get it there. And then when you've got it there, if it's selling, hey, make sure people know about it and use it to get people into the stores. So you've got to think about, you know, merchandising. You've got to think about promotions. You've got to think about marketing. You've got to think about PR. So you've immediately, in a space of a week, 10 days, got to bring this collection of people across the globe, empower decision-making at the front line, and bring them together to be able to get those gray pencil skirts from Seville to Manila and make some more money. And that's what they do. And again, if you think that emailing documents around is how they do it, I've got a secret. That's not. It's about saving, you know, to the cloud. It's about rapidly iterating. It's about using social technology. So these are two of the ways that, you know, the biggest ways that we see things developing. So as I think about that, how that relates to the shift, I sort of, we bubble it into these sort of three areas. I think about the networks, and when I say collective value creation, to me, this is about the shift from individual-centric work to collective work, like that Zara example. Then we have the sort of the insight trend, And then lastly, security. And so when we think about reinventing productivity, we think about these three areas and how we're going to reinvent productivity. And these are explicit goals that we set with the engineering team. And this is how the engineers think about, even if you're a frontline coder on OneDrive for Business, they think about how does this relate into these three areas? You know, am I building for a team versus an individual? You know, am I focused on how do I drive insight versus just big data? And is this going to be secure? So let's sort of step through them. First off, this trend of built for teams and networks. This picture is a shot from our offices in Zurich. And I love it because it talks to a couple of different sort of bits and pieces. You know, you've got ad hoc collaboration. You know, you need to have, the other thing this triggers is the physical space that people are working in we see changing as well. Conference rooms are a great case in point, you know, over here. We redo conference rooms on campus, you know, routinely. At the low end, they cost anywhere from $25,000 US up to, you know, if you're putting in a telepresence room, it could be $250,000. So, you know, they're very expensive things. But, you know, here, you know, rather than a whiteboard, we've got one of those Surface Hubs that people have been talking about. I have a Surface Hub in my office, one of the 55-inch ones. I tell this story as much to show off the fact that I have a Surface Hub in my office, as to also illustrate or sort of talk about how my work has changed. I used to be one of those people that had whiteboards everywhere, literally. You know, every space that wasn't a window, and I used the windows as whiteboards as well, was a whiteboard. Now, I don't use them, because why would I? You know, I love OneNote as an example, and whenever I'm on the Surface Hub, everything is already captured. If I'm working with people and you're iterating on a deck and you can bring people in on Skype, for example, you know, it makes a fundamental difference. So, you know, how do we power meetings? You know, you've got the ad hoc stuff, bringing people together. Dude on the beanbag. Dude on the beanbag for me is about mobility. And then someone back, you know, back here, some poor sod has still got to do some work with a mouse and a keyboard. You know, so it's not about this versus this. You know, this is where, you know, often these days the trendy, you know, competitor is Slack. You know, so you get the customers who, you know, come in and, you know, the smart question is like, so, you know, what about Slack? You know, Slack is going to kill email. Well, I mean, I've been doing this for 11 years. Everybody's been saying that email's going to die for 11 years. Doesn't really show many signs of dying. I don't think Slack is the sort of the answer because, again, you're creating another silo. How do you empower, you know, the ad hoc, the mobile, the meetings, the desk work. It's not about one or the other. You know, collectively, these people working together are greater than the sum of their constituent parts. And I think a lot of the pure play apps focus on one of these scenarios versus thinking holistically about all of them. So building for teams for networks, the other facet of this is, again, I mentioned it, the shift from me-centric work to we-centric work. You know, when I started, you were expected to sort of kind of go away, work by yourself, and come back with a near-finished product and, you know, maybe do a review cycle or something. Now, and this, again, is one of those shifts driven in no small part by the millennials, think about crowdsourcing. You know, I mentioned the engineers on Yammer crowdsourcing ideas. Do you like widget A? Do you like widget B? You know, that's using a team or a network, rather, to help inform how we make engineering decisions. Likewise, when I do this presentation, we were talking about it down here at the front before, you know, I solicit feedback on Yammer, and I'll put out early versions of the slides and try and get feedback from people. And people will have ideas that I didn't have or didn't imagine, which is fantastic. So that's an explicit goal for us. Meetings are a key scenario, because when we think about empowering people to do more, yes, individual work is important, and sometimes we've all got to go off and, you know, do some modeling or, you know, respond to an RFP or do some architecture or whatever it might be. But most of the time, where I actually get work done and where I move things forward or we collectively agree on how we are going to move things forward is in a meeting. But I suppose most of us, you know, have spent enough time in meetings to know that some of them are god-awful, and that's when you're in the room, let alone if you're a virtual participant. You know, if you're a virtual participant, I'm a very visual person, so audio, you know, there's this sort of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. People think there are three different types of people: audio, visual, kinesthetic. Kinesthetic people feel things, visual people, you know, need to see things, audio people want to hear things. And in this room, it's not a case of you're one or the other. Everybody is kind of a mix of these things. You know, most people have one being dominant. So my dominance is, you know, visual. So when I'm sitting there on a conference call and the people haven't fired up, you know, because they've got a little post-it note on their webcam, you know, I'm missing out I'm not seeing the whiteboard. I'm not seeing the faces of people that are speaking. So, you know, that is an area where we're sort of focused on. So as an example of what we're changing here, we've seen that most meetings in Office 365, and we schedule about 80 million meetings in Exchange Online a month, most of those, around 75%, end up being Skype meetings or Link meetings, you know, Skype for Business. But interestingly, only 30% start off in when the person creates the meetings, starts off as being a Skype meeting. But what happens is people like me who are traveling is like, hey, I'm down in Auckland, can you add Skype? You know, these days we should just assume because people are working in a disparate way. So what are we doing? We're changing it such that by default, you know, and again, admins can tweak this if needed, but by default, Outlook meetings, Exchange meetings, are going to have Skype for Business information if that's in the plan. Other things, with the Surface Hub, when you go up and you touch into a Surface Hub or you use a Skype Room system, it automatically turns on the camera, just does it. And most people don't even realize it. So they don't, you know, in a room with the Skype Room systems. I'm not talking about the sort of the bedroom scenario where people could be in their bathrobe. But that's fantastic because then they don't even need to think about it because most people don't want to, you know, learn how to do that. And then lastly, if you add in attachments into that Outlook meeting request, it will automatically be uploaded into that Skype meeting. So when you join that Skype meeting as a participant, those attachments are already there, right there in that Skype for Business meeting. So those are just some of the things that we're sort of focused on at the moment and examples of how we're trying to sort of help improve meetings. Next up, content co-creation. This, again, very much ties to that shift from me-centric work to we-centric work. I take for granted now that I can start work on my desktop in my office, leave. We have a bus network. We are spoiled rotten in Seattle. You know, Microsoft has a bus network, you know, with Wi-Fi and whatnot. I can leave, I can be on the bus, and I can be on my iPhone and be using the apps, you know, the Word, Excel, PowerPoint apps, you know, continue doing some editing, review a document, get home, you know, use a PC or my partner's MacBook. Or when I'm traveling, you know, with, you know, generally speaking, pretty crappy hotel Wi-Fi, I'll often use the Office Online, you know, the web clients, so I'm not having to pull down. Like this presentation is 340 megabytes. It's got a video in it. Can you imagine pulling down 340 plus megabytes on a, you know, crappy hotel Wi-Fi? It would, you know, be horrific. So I use the online. But you take that for granted, and the ability to bring people in, to share it rapidly, all of those sort of bits and pieces. So, you know, saving to the cloud, really big deal here. The ability to rapidly iterate, get feedback, you know, using things like Yammer and social tools or, you know, Office 365 groups. And that sort of touches on the idea of mobility. You know, mobility is a funny one because everybody sort of focuses on, you know, devices. Oh, you know, how does it work on the iPhone or how does it work on the Android? We actually think about sort of the human experience because, you know, if I put my phone down over here, you know, or leave it in my desk and sort of, you know, walk away. You know, how mobile is the phone? No, it's not particularly mobile. The human is the thing that's mobile. So for us, it's about the mobility of the experience and having a consistent experience across all of those different areas. And it's interesting the shift that's had in our business. It's taken us 30 years to develop a business where we sell 75 million copies of Office, you know, full package product every single year. In less than 1 year, from the moment at which we released Office for iPad and then subsequently all of the Android apps and the other apps on iPhone, we had over 100 million downloads of those apps in the iOS or in the App Store and Google Play. You know, so we now, you know, 75 million copies of Office a year, took us 30 years. Less than a year, 100 million downloads of the apps. Helps that they're free, but shows how rapidly things are changing. The final piece of how we think about the first chapter, Building for Teams and Networks, is around this concept of digital storytelling. And yes, I am that narcissistic that I put myself in the presentation. This is actually my PPI in my office. And then this is Marissa, who's one of my colleagues, who runs actually IT Pro Marketing on that Office 365 technical network. Now, we kind of staged this, but this is using Sway. How many people have seen Sway or used Sway? Okay, not too many. Sway, if you go to sway.com, there's a consumer service, and then there's also now Sway as part of the Office 365. You can sign in with your Office 365 credentials. Sway is a fundamental shift, and there's more to storytelling than just Sway, but Sway is the prototypical example in my mind. If you think about Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, that paradigm is what you see is what you get. It's all, you know, you have to tell it bold, italic, blue, you know, font 12, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, when you fire up Word, what do you get? You get a piece of paper. You get a digital manifestation of a piece of paper. How much do you actually really print these days? Probably not as much. Yes, I know some organizations still love killing trees. But for the most part, when I see paper in a meeting at Microsoft, like, I get scared if there's too much of it. You know, it hurts when you get the paper cuts. But we don't print stuff out. But we're using a tool that is skeuomorphic in terms of, you know, a piece of paper. When, with a digital canvas, why are you limiting yourself to a digital manifestation of a piece of paper? So with Sway, the paradigm is shifting from what you see is what you get to what you want is what you get. It's using algorithms and a design engine in the background. And in fact, the guy, the genius behind Sway is a guy called Chris Prattley, who's the guy who came up with OneNote in the first place, which is kind of interesting. He has a Porsche 911 with the license plate OneNote. It's kind of cool. I don't know whether I'm more jealous of the license plate or the car. So he's the guy who came up with Sway. So what happens is Sway is plugged into all of these different consumer services as well as the enterprise, you know, OneDrive for Business, all of that sort of good stuff. But on the consumer side, you know, YouTube, Flickr, you know, OneDrive Consumer, all of those sort of things. And you're able to go out and pull in photos, pull in videos, all of those sort of bits and pieces. And Sway will reflow things, and it goes to the level of looking at the Pantone colors in the pictures that you, or the videos that you upload, and therefore choosing a color palette, or having a range of color palettes available for you. And you can tweak things, but it's trying to take, you know, not all of us are designers, not all of us have designers on staff. So it's being the designer in the background for you, but in this world where, again, rapid iteration, sharing online, and again, across multiple different form factors. This is me using the Sway app, and we have apps in the App Store for iOS for both iPad and iPhone, and it'll be coming to Windows, or we have a Windows 10 modern app as well. But this is just in the browser, and it, you hit a Sway just with a link. And Sway on the back end, you know, is figuring out, okay, I'm on an 84-inch, you know, perceptive pixel, you know, multi-touch display versus, oh, I'm in the app and I'm on an iPad. And it's automatically reflowing content. Anyone who's ever done web design knows how difficult it is sometimes thinking about resolutions, different screen displays, you know, all of those sort of bits and pieces. Same with, mobile design. So Sway takes advantage of that. And it just helps you get out of the business of worrying about, you know, size 12, blue, font, italic, blah, 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 and get in the business of, hey, here's the content. How am I going to present this most compellingly? So I, you know, really, I'd encourage you to check out Sway. It's a fantastic app. Next two slides sort of shift a little bit. This, a lot of people talk about explosion of devices, and you'll see that, you know, devices in the conventional sense are forecast to grow and continue to grow through the end of the decade. But the real explosion is in the sort of the IoT sensors. And what that's driving is this explosion of data from 0.16 of a zettabyte in 2006 to an anticipated 44 zettabytes of information in 2020. So lots of devices, more data. And one zettabyte equals 1 billion terabytes. Now, what's interesting about this is I think people sometimes talk about BI and big data. It's like, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to invest in BI and big data. To my mind, those are trends. And data without insight is nothing. Satya, I think, puts it really nicely. And this is my gratuitous CEO shot quote. What's scarce in all of this abundance is human attention. And that is just so true. For me, the best example of how this impacts me as a human and an individual is in my ability to triage and filter my email. We term it now email bankruptcy. I have over 1,500 unread emails in my inbox. And as a, you know, slightly OCD Virgo, that actually drives me nuts. But I've kind of had to come to terms with the fact that I'm just never going to get to all of them. So we have to have a different way of sort of filtering and signaling. So things like using the Office Graph, which is this intelligent fabric, you know, in the service, to help filter the inbox to the things that it knows that I'm really only going to be interested in, to help me, you know, tackle that volume of information. That's a great example of personal insight. Another great example, Excel. You know, Excel is the world's preeminent, you know, BI tool. Every organization I've ever worked in, voluntary, Army, Microsoft, runs on Excel. Yes, you can have Cognos or Tableau or some fancy BI thing that you pay a lot of money for. But most people, work gets done in Excel. Modeling gets done in Excel. You know, without Excel, the banks stop working. So how do we make Excel as powerful as possible? How do we tie Power BI into Excel and make it the de facto sort of BI tool? And then organizational insight is interesting. This is a new shift for us. We've been talking about personal insight for a while, the last year or so. But organizational insight is a new trend for us. And this is about how do we empower organizations. And I'm going to show you an evolution of Delve, which is to date, Delve has been a personal experience to help people find information and discover information around them. Delve Org Analytics is about, it's like having a Fitbit for work. It's helping you figure out whether you're in the right meetings, whether your team is making the right connections. And so that's an interesting shift. And then last piece of the puzzle, security. This is the easiest trend in the world to talk about because I can just sort of stand up here and wave my arms and say Sony, Target, North Korea, criminal gangs. Security is a huge challenge. Our focus on how we think about changing it or addressing this is in terms of people centricity. And what I mean by this is, think of that Sky call center example. Sky, I didn't tell you the name of the customer. The broadcaster in Scotland. It's Rupert Murdoch. I don't really care for Rupert. That example where his employees found a way around not having IM and had IM anyway. The knee-jerk reaction 10 years ago talking to technologists was, oh, I'll block it. I'll block the port. I won't have IM. That doesn't work anymore. They're going to bring in their iPhones. They're going to bring in their iPads. They're going to bring in, hopefully, some of them might bring in a Windows phone one of these days. But this idea that you can stop devices or SaaS apps from coming into your organization is, these days, patently absurd. So how do we think about our tools and making them as easy as possible to empower the individual to do the right thing? So whether that's tooltips right there in Outlook or an Outlook web app saying, hey, you're about to send this outside of your organization. Do you mean to do that? Or, oh, it looks like the attachment has some credit card information or some personally identifiable. Are you sure you want to do that? So helping them make the right choice. You saw Joe Belfiore do the demo. Actually, you saw Catherine, who's a really good friend of mine. We didn't just sort of bring her down because she was a Kiwi, but she does actually work on that security aspect in Windows. Show how you can easily encrypt corporate data, empower people on their own personal devices, but then protect them from themselves, to not tweet it out or what have you. That's a great example of how we think about people centricity and security. People centric also is about how we think about IT and other roles in the organization. So helping IT, get out of the speeds and feeds of managing the forefront online protection sort of whitelist, blacklist. We should just be able to do that ourselves and not have you sort of do that unless it's absolutely necessary or custom to your organization. And then the final piece around how do you empower compliance officers or legal officers, when there's an e-discovery need or a compliance hold, to be able to do that themselves without relying on IT. So that's a good example of how we think about people centricity. So with that, let me shift over, show you a couple of bits and pieces. I'm not going to do Skype for Business. Oh, it restarted on me, which is nice. Let's start off with Outlook. And actually, whilst Outlook's doing, I'm going to bring up Internet Explorer. And we're going to bring up, I had this all stacked up. Chris Capicella. Do people know Chris? He's the only person I know who can type and talk at the same time. It's actually a very useful skill set. All right, here we are in Outlook. I wanted to show you an example. We've just been talking about security of some of the advances. One of the new things that we've introduced is called Advanced Threat Protection. And this is a good example. I'm pandering to the audience here by using a local example. But this is not to say that ANZ has any security breaches, but this is just a phishing attack. And you can see this by sort of hovering over, a sensible user will have a look at that link and know, that's wrong. But just in case they do click on it, what happens is on the back end, Office 365 and the Advanced Threat Protection has gone, checked out that website, knows that it's malicious, and it's preventing you from going there. So we recommend that you close this web page and not continue to this website. Now, and as an admin, you have the ability to say, can they actually override that or can they not? So that's a good example. And now if we go back, here, the link in the footer is actually just the ANZ website. So it's sensible enough to know, what's a good link, what's a bad link. And this is not based on a whitelist or a blacklist. This is dynamically looking at what's coming into our digital crimes unit. It's looking at what's on the website, what malware or executables are on the website, and it's making that determination in real time as opposed to being a very binary, whitelist, blacklist. So Now, my personal favorite thing, and this is Outlook 2016. This is the new app that's going to be launched on September 22nd. If you're an Office 365 customer already, and you go to office.com, you'll be able to download it, you know, when it's released. My favorite new feature is two things. First of all, this most recently used. You know, if you're in Excel as an example, you know, we've become used to having most recently used, you know, down the side, or when we open things up. And that's great, but now in the Outlook client, we're bringing that most recently used file in there because most of the time you're sort of going to be sharing something that you know you want there. Now, if I go and click on a link here, what it's going to do is it's going to attach it to the mail, but it looks like an attachment, feels like an attachment, but you know just has that little cloud there. What it is it's sharing a link. In reality, what it's doing, and you could, when you upload a normal attachment, this is on the desktop, you can have the option to upload automatically into OneDrive. So you can get people out of the business of emailing around documents to collaborate on, you know, because when they email it, it's going to put it in a OneDrive, and who you send this to will indicate permissions for a document. But in reality, so you're not having to change end users' behavior, but we're helping save them from themselves in terms of everybody's then working off the same document. And I think we have tooltips in here. So if I just do my email address, you might get the tooltip. Oh, no, can't show mail tips. I don't know. But you know what you'd get up here in that mail tip is, hey, you're sending this to an external party. So again, it's right there in the client, you know, helping prevent people from themselves. And now the final thing I wanted to show you in Outlook was clutter. It's just a folder. And most people think it's like junk mail. It's not like junk mail, because junk mail, again, is based on a very dumb sort of set of lists. Clutter is powered by the Office Graph, and it's filtering away the things that I'm not going to pay as much attention to. And the Office Graph, most people have been thinking about Delve as the example, or they think of Delve and Office Graph as the same thing, when in reality, the Office Graph is this intelligent fabric across the service that powers these experiences like Delve, like Clutter. So every single time you send an email or an instant message send an email with a subject line or fire up a meeting, you know, and the meeting title, you are sending both a content and a social signal. The content signal is, you know, is this a Word document and it's saying blah. The social signal is I'm sending this to you on the to line and only to you. And if I'm sending it only to you, that's a very strong social signal that we have a very direct relationship. If you are on the CC line and there are 50 other people on the CC line, you know, clearly the strength of that relationship isn't as good. So what you see here with Delve is, this is my Delve homepage, you see these cards, and these are not, I'm not searching for these things, but it knows who I am, it knows who I work with, it knows what people that I'm working with, what they're working on, and knows what I'm interested in. And it's kind of, you know, surfacing these things up for me. It's kind of like, think of it as your, you know, the top results or whatever on your Facebook newsfeed, and just for work. And a lot of people have tried to say that that's it for Delve, and that's not it. Other people say it's like Pinterest for work, and it's actually bigger than that. The reason they say Pinterest is because you have these things called boards. So down here on the left-hand side, you can curate a board on a particular topic. It could be mail delivery in Rotorua for NZ Post. I don't know, you know, just a random example. And that's kind of the Pinterest model. But you've got all of these different things powered by the Office Graph. And if I show you the Delve org analytics piece, so this is the evolution of how Delve is going to be used, not just for the personal insight, but also the organizational insight. Let me bump up this a little bit so you can see a little bit better. What you see here is this idea. I can't move around on the screen, unfortunately. This my team, and you can see the connections. So immediately as a manager, I can get a sense of, oh, you know, we're not actually spending as much time with Mario's team here. Maybe we're spending too much time with the product team, and, you know, begin to get a sense of that. And I can dive in and have a look at meetings, for example. This is the meetings tab, and I can see my time versus company average versus my peers. Likewise, I can then go and have a look at my team versus the company versus the peers. So you can quickly get a sense for, you know, how are different people sort of, you know, working. This is all based on the sort of the same permissions model, you know, based on SharePoint, based on Delve. So you only see what you're allowed to see, and different organizations can think about how they want to sort of enact this. You know, it's not a case of you can go around the organization and start stalking people and how much meeting time they have. This is just my team. And you can see it gives you stats on, you know, time during business hours, time with other teams. Likewise, you get these sort of, you know, the what's trending. And so you can go in and have a look at HoloLens, for example. And I can see that Jem's team, you know, has a much stronger affinity to HoloLens. So if I want to know about HoloLens, you know, rather than just randomly asking people, you know, I'm going to go and talk to Jem. So this is a good example of how that shift from personal insight to organizational insight. I'm not going to show you the Excel pieces because I've talked too much already, but what I do want to show you is the Power BI. How many people are using Power BI today? Oh, just a couple of people. Power BI is I adore. It's pretty powerful, and it's changing from just a you know, how you can sort of slice and dice, you know, data and create dashboards. And Joe tried to show Cortana, you know, working with Power BI. You know, and this is the point where, you know, I'm going to throw, you know, Kiwi internet under the bus. Clearly it wasn't working that day. Can't be Cortana. So what he did here, let's go in Power BI demo. I want to show this one. The idea of using Cortana to interact with Power BI, show me, you know, X, show me Y, and without having to slice and dice by yourself. Yeah, Power BI is, unfortunately, we had this all queued up. It doesn't look, again, I'm going to blame the Kiwi Wi-Fi. It's totally not my fault or Windows 10 fault. Here we go. Ask with Power BI. I mentioned I'm a visual person. I'm not that sort of business analyst that looks at a spreadsheet and can see, see the matrix. You know, I need the visuals. And so what we've got here is the ability to just ask Power BI about data. So I'm going to say sales amount. And that's, you can see it brings it up. And that's just a sort of, you know, a static amount. All right. But what about if I want sales and category? And that's interesting because it's already, you see, it was already predicting a little bit like a web search, you know, what I might want. It's looking at the data, it's anticipating what I might want, you know, and prompting me, you know, for stuff it can bring me. And rather than just showing me numbers, it's thought, oh, this is going to be better as a chart. Now, but what if I want and profit? No. I actually want to see and country. Now, here we go, you know, enable the content. And there you go. It's pulling in Bing Maps, and it's overlaying the data onto, you know, Bing Maps. And this is just an Excel sheet in the background, you know, and I'm using Power BI to interact with it, asking it very natural queries. I will show you actually one thing on Excel. This is a new charting engine, so if I go into the forecast, here's one I made earlier. This is, you know, historical data. I'm just going to select all of this. And this is the new Tell Me feature in Office 2016. So, you know, helping end users find what they want sort of quickly. So if I want to insert a forecast sheet, it's right there. You know, I haven't gone to sort of peck around in Excel to find it. I'm going to tell it to create that forecast sheet. And you'll see what it's done is it's taken those historicals. So all I selected were historicals. And these are the historicals in blue. And I'm going to change this. Oh, not that. Because I like this one. I'm going to change this. It's taken the historicals, and then it's gone and it's predicted the median and the upper bound and the lower bound based on those historicals of, you know, my forecast for the different sort of products. And this is just built into Excel. There's no sort of magic on the back end. It's taking a data set and it's helping, you know, do forecasting, which I think, you know, most people at some point, you know, have to do. So that's a good example, again, of how we're thinking about that personal, you know, insight. So with that, let me just come over back across and sum up. I've got about 5 minutes left. One thing I want to hammer home is just the pace of change with the cloud versus the on-premises model. You know, we're no less committed to on-premises than we were sort of 5 years ago, but there's a difference in the sense that we're able to do more in the cloud. The Office Graph is a good example of that. We simply couldn't deliver that on-premises. So the cadence on-premises is unchanged. We still plan on releasing, and we're just about to release on September 22nd, a new Office 2016 client. And then in the next sort of 6 months, you'll see Exchange, SharePoint, and Skype for Business servers for on-premises use. And we're focused on taking the learnings from running Office 365 and building those into the server products. And that's interesting. You know, the last release was the point at which Office 365 and the servers caught up and got parity. Now, since then, Office 365, we did over 400 updates in the last year. So the day after, like September 23rd, we're going to release Office, September 22nd, we're going to release Office 2016. September 23rd, no doubt, there'll be an update to Office 365 Pro Plus, you know, the client, the streamed client version. So if you're getting Office, the client apps through Office 365, you'll get an update and you'll be up to date, and Office 2016 on premises will already be out of date. You know, we just, the model has changed. In this world of increased agility, that's really where we see most people moving. And that's evident by the sort of the momentum. 60% of the new business this year for the division is going to be Office 365 versus the on-premises. And that's shifted from 6 years ago where it was zero. So zero to 60% in 6 years. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. And it's growing triple-digit growth every single quarter. Always evolving, you know, the big pieces for the next sort of few months. Obviously, Office 2016, I talked about the servers. Delve Org Analytics is going to start rolling out in preview in the next sort of few months. Huge stuff coming with Skype. Love what's coming with Skype. First of all, Skype meetings broadcast. You know, Link has always had that 250 user limit. With Skype meetings broadcast, when it releases, it's going to be available for meetings of up to 10,000 people. And the team have all the intentions of getting to, you know, 100,000 users. You know, they're saying 10,000 to kind of hedge their bets and build it out and sort of make sure it's scalable and whatnot. But they, you know, want to evolve that. So, you know, having these huge, large-scale meetings. And likewise, moving some of the voice components into the cloud. So we're going to have PSTN in and out in the United States before the end of this calendar year. And then over the next 18 months, 2 years, we don't have a timetable as yet. It'll roll out around the world. So, you know, that will actually be a sort of fundamental shift in how Skype and voice calling works. Customer lockbox, if you haven't come across, this is fantastic. You know, there's that, I mentioned that knee-jerk reaction. You know, the on-premises is always going to be more secure. You know, nonsense. But the other part of that is comfort and familiarity. And that I get more than this idea that the belief that you can actually be more secure on premises. I don't believe that. The comfort piece and understanding it and having control, I totally get. Customer lockbox is interesting. So at the moment, we basically have zero standing rights into the environment for admins. And most of the admin tasks that we need to perform on a customer environment are automated, so software-driven versus human-driven. In the very rare instance that we need to go in as a human being into a customer environment, it's tracked. You know, each mouse stroke, each keystroke is tracked. And before an individual gets that access, it's like a nuclear submarine, sort of, you know, with the two keys. Two managers at Microsoft have to turn the keys and give them time-bound specific permissions that are then tracked and audited and available to a customer. With customer lockbox, we're bringing the customer, and also before they get to the nuclear key thing, that has to be in response to a service request raised by a customer, where they can't just sort of make this up. What we're doing with customer lockbox is bringing customers into that key process. So not only do they have to initiate the service request process, but then the customer, the admin, gets that key. You know, so in addition to two Microsoft managers with background checks and vetting and all that sort of stuff, now there's a third key, and the customer gets the, yes, I want to give someone this permission for this amount of time on this person's mailbox. And then they, as I say, can go back in and check all the auditing logs and controls. So that's actually a big advance, and we're pretty excited about that. So with that, I want to make sure that we have a little bit of time to show the sort of the future video at the end. Let me just sum up. We've talked about these sort of these three areas. So the macro trend is that reinventing productivity and business process, and how we plan on doing that is in terms of this principle of building for teams and networks, personal org insights, and people-centric security. None of these investments that we're making would be possible without the support of our customers. So the very fact that you've come to the first Microsoft Ignite conference, I realize that it's an evolution of TechEd, but you know, it's a proud moment for us. We had 23,000 in Chicago for the first Ignite conference. This is the only other Ignite conference we do worldwide. But thank you very much for coming to Ignite. Thank you for coming to my session, perhaps more importantly. I appreciate that first session of the day. What I'd like to leave you with is a glimpse into, I've talked about the next sort of year to 18 months. I'll leave you with a glimpse in terms of where we're headed in the next 5 to 7 years. All of the prototypes that you see and all of the mock-ups and screenshots that you see, not so much the screenshots, but the scenarios and the technology that you see in this video are actually actively being worked on at Microsoft in some places. So with that, let's roll the video. love that music. I mentioned the monthly webcast series that we do. It's called Modern Workplace, modernworkplace.com. We do topics like security, social in the enterprise, millennials, all these sort of bits and pieces. The last one was actually with our Chief Marketing Officer, Chris Capicella, and Amy Batinsky, who is the CMO of Zillow, talking about the evolving role of the CMO. And we're starting off this month back with our second season for the office launch. So if you're interested, modernworkplace.com. You can check out the previous episodes and sign up for the new ones. With that, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Have a fantastic remainder of Ignite. I'll stick around if you've got any questions. But thank you so much.